George Eliot's masterpiece continues to captivate readers nearly 150 years after its publication, earning praise from Virginia Woolf as one of the few English novels written for grown-up people. This sprawling narrative of provincial life has influenced generations of writers and thinkers, from Julian Barnes to Zadie Smith. What makes Middlemarch so enduring? Perhaps it's Eliot's remarkable psychological insight, her compassionate yet unflinching portrayal of human nature, or her ability to weave individual stories into a rich tapestry of community life. The novel asks us, how do our highest aspirations fare when confronted with the constraints of society and our own limitations? Can we reconcile our ideals with the messy realities of life? These questions remain as relevant today as they were in Victorian England, making Middlemarch not just a literary classic, but a living, breathing exploration of the human condition. Dorothea Brooke embodies the novel's central tension between idealism and reality in Victorian society. Young, beautiful, and intensely idealistic, she yearns for a life of meaningful contribution rather than the ornamental existence expected of women in her social position. What could she do? What ought she to do? Becomes her driving question, one that haunts her daily thoughts and shapes her decisions. Unlike other young women of her station who concern themselves with balls and bonnets, Dorothea finds fashion trivial, considering it absurd against the great scheme of truth. Her religious fervor manifests in practical ways. She meticulously designs cottages for laborers, studies land management texts, and dreams of improving tenant conditions on her uncle's estate through scientific farming methods. When we first encounter Dorothea, she's living at Tipton Grange with her uncle, Mr. Brooke, a well-meaning but ineffectual landlord, alongside her more conventional sister, Celia. While Celia delights in jewelry and social niceties, embracing the expected pleasures of provincial gentility, Dorothea seeks deeper intellectual and spiritual fulfillment. She spends hours reading religious texts, studying architecture, and contemplating social reform. This passionate search for meaning leads her to Edward Casaubon, a dried-up scholar many years her senior, whom she idealizes as a great soul who might guide her to profound knowledge. Despite pointed warnings from her sister, her uncle, and even the shrewd neighbor Sir James Chettam, Dorothea sees in Casaubon the opportunity for a fuller life, with room for the energies which stirred uneasily under the dimness and pressure of her own ignorance. Her marriage to Casaubon quickly reveals itself as a profound mistake, a revelation that unfolds with painful clarity during their honeymoon in Rome. The Eternal City, rather than expanding her horizons, becomes the setting for her disillusionment. Dorothea discovers that her husband's mind contains not large vistas and fresh air, but winding passages leading nowhere. His scholarly work, an ambitious project called Key to All Mythologies, proves hopelessly outdated and futile, built on crumbling foundations of outdated scholarship and inability to read German sources. Yet he demands her assistance in this pointless endeavor, and, more cruelly, extracts a promise for her eventual devotion to completing it after his death. The marriage transforms into a prison of mutual disappointment, with Casaubon growing increasingly jealous and suspicious, particularly of his young cousin Will Ladislaw, while Dorothea's vibrant spirit withers under his cold precision and emotional neglect. Dorothea's journey powerfully illuminates the novel's exploration of female potential constrained by social limitations. Like Saint Teresa in the novel's prelude, she possesses a passionate nature, demanding an epic life, yet finds no clear channel for her energies in a society that expects women to be decorative rather than useful. Her struggle represents countless women whose ardor alternated between vague ideals and common yearnings, their lives appearing as mere inconsistency rather than noble purpose. Through Dorothea's character, Eliot asks whether meaningful action is possible within the confines of provincial Victorian womanhood, and offers a complex, nuanced answer that suggests both the limitations of circumstance and the possibility of finding purpose within those constraints. Her story becomes a meditation on the nature of vocation itself, questioning whether grand gestures are necessary for a life of significance, or if meaning can be found in smaller, more intimate forms of goodness. Middlemarch itself functions almost as a character in the novel, a provincial town with its own ecology of relationships, hierarchies, and unwritten rules that shape the destiny of its inhabitants. Eliot creates an intricate social web where individual actions reverberate through the community, affecting lives in unexpected ways. The town represents a microcosm of English society during a period of significant change, with the Reform Bill of 1832 looming in the background, and technological innovations like railways threatening traditional ways of life. This setting becomes a laboratory for examining how social forces both enable and constrain human potential. The social structure of Middlemarch operates through carefully maintained distinctions and complex hierarchies. The landed gentry, represented by figures like Sir James Chetham and the Brooke family, maintain their position at the top through inherited wealth and careful marriage alliances. The professional class of doctors, lawyers, and clergy occupy the middle ranks, with characters like Lydgate and Fairbrother illustrating the precarious nature of maintaining respectability on limited means. Businessmen like Mr. Vincey, the manufacturer, represent rising commercial interests that challenge traditional power structures, while farmers like Caleb Garth embody honest labor connected to the land, a connection that earns respect but limited social mobility. At the bottom are laborers like Dagley, whose confrontation with Mr. Brooke reveals the simmering class tensions beneath the surface of polite society. Religion and politics divide the town in subtle but significant ways. The evangelical banker Bulstrode wields influence through his wealth and religious authority, using both to maintain moral control over the community while hiding his own dark past. More traditional Anglicans like the Cadwalladers represent the established church and its deep connections to landed interests. Political allegiances split between conservative landowners protecting their privileges and progressive reformers seeking change, with Mr. Brooke's ill-fated political ambitions exposing both the challenges of genuine reform and the resistance of entrenched interests. The Reform Bill serves as a backdrop that heightens these tensions, forcing characters to take sides and reveal their true values. Gossip serves as both social glue and weapon in Middlemarch, operating through an elaborate network of drawing rooms, dinner parties, and chance encounters. News travels with remarkable speed through these channels, shaping reputations and fortunes with often devastating effect. When scandal erupts around Bulstrode's past and Lydgate's association with him, the town's reaction reveals how quickly public opinion can turn against individuals who violate social norms, whether through actual misconduct or mere association. Mrs. Cadwalladr, with her sharp tongue and strategic matchmaking tendencies, exemplifies how gossip maintains social boundaries by identifying and punishing transgressors while simultaneously reinforcing acceptable behavior patterns. The novel's genius lies in showing how these social forces shape individual destinies in ways both subtle and profound. Characters must navigate this complex terrain while pursuing their personal goals, often finding that their fates are determined as much by community perception as by their own choices. Young idealists like Dorothea and Lydgate discover that their grand ambitions must contend with the practical limitations imposed by provincial society. As Eliot writes, "For there is no creature whose inward being is so strong that it is not greatly determined by what lies outside it." This interplay between individual aspiration and social constraint becomes the central drama of the novel, played out against a community that both nurtures and stifles its members. Tertius Lydgate arrives in Middlemarch with grand ambitions to revolutionize medical practice and contribute to scientific knowledge. Young, brilliant, and confident, he represents the novel's most explicit embodiment of professional idealism. His goal is nothing less than discovering the primitive tissue from which all others develop, a breakthrough that would transform medical understanding. Alongside this scientific pursuit, he aims to reform provincial medicine through evidence-based practice at the new hospital. Lydgate's ambitions clash immediately with Middlemarch reality. The town's established doctors, Wrench, Toller, Minchin, and Sprague, view his modern methods with suspicion, seeing them as implicit criticism of their own practices. Their resistance manifests in professional jealousy and exclusion, with patients divided into competing camps of strengtheners versus lowerers based on treatment philosophy. Lydgate's association with the evangelical banker Bulstrode further damages his standing among the town's traditional elite. His downfall comes through a fatal combination of professional isolation and personal weakness. Despite his intellectual gifts, Lydgate lacks the social intelligence to navigate Middlemarch politics. His vote for Bulstrode's candidate as hospital chaplain alienates potential allies like Fairbrother, while his contempt for provincial pettiness prevents him from building necessary social connections. Most fatally, he underestimates the power of public opinion when scandal erupts around Bulstrode and Raffles' death. Lydgate's marriage to Rosamund Vincey represents his greatest personal failure. Attracted by her polished, refined, docile manner, he imagines her as the perfect doctor's wife who will provide sweet furtherance of satisfying affection. Instead, Rosamund's expensive tastes and rigid social aspirations trap him in mounting debt. When financial crisis strikes, she proves incapable of adapting to reduced circumstances, forcing him to compromise his professional integrity by accepting money from Bulstrode, a decision that later appears as complicity in wrongdoing. The tragedy of Lydgate lies in watching his noble ambitions gradually erode under financial pressure, social isolation, and domestic unhappiness. By the novel's end, he has abandoned his research and become a fashionable doctor to wealthy patients with gout, precisely the kind of practice he once despised. His death at 50 represents the novel's starkest example of thwarted potential, a man who regarded himself as a failure. He had not done what he once meant to do. Money flows through Middlemarch like blood through veins, determining relationships, opportunities, and social standing. The novel meticulously tracks financial transactions and their consequences, from Fred Vincey's debt to Lydgate's bankruptcy to Dorothea's inheritance. These economic realities shape characters' choices and reveal their values with unflinching clarity. Marriage functions primarily as an economic institution, with romantic love often secondary to financial considerations. The novel opens with the Brooks sisters as heiresses with $700 a year each, their marriage prospects enhanced by their uncle's estate worth about $3,000 a year. Casaubon's proposal to Dorothea includes detailed discussion of settlements, while Rosamund calculates Lydgate's connections to baronets and landed gentlemen as part of his appeal. Even Fred and Mary's long-delayed marriage depends on his securing financial stability through managing Stone Court. Inheritance drives multiple plot lines, most notably the drama surrounding old Peter Featherstone's will. The disappointed relatives at his funeral, the Vincys, Walls, and Garths, reveal how inheritance expectations shape family relationships and personal identities. Fred Vincey's character development hinges on losing his expected inheritance from Featherstone and learning to earn his own living. Similarly, Bulstrode's past sins involve diverting an inheritance from its rightful heirs, while his attempt at redemption includes returning Stone Court to the Vincey family through Fred's management. Debt functions as both plot device and moral test throughout the novel. Fred's debt to Caleb Garth, secured by Mary's father's signature, becomes the catalyst for his transformation from idle gentleman to working land manager. Lydgate's mounting debts reveal both his naivete about practical matters and Rosamund's inflexible social aspirations. The power of creditors, from Dover's execution on Lydgate's property to the tradesmen who refuse further credit, demonstrates how financial obligations constrain freedom and compromise integrity. The novel's economic landscape reflects the changing reality of 1830s England, with traditional landed wealth, represented by the Chethams and Brookes, increasingly challenged by commercial success, the Vincys, and financial manipulation, Bulstrode. Through these economic relationships, Eliot explores how money shapes character, testing principles and exposing weaknesses that might otherwise remain hidden. As Mr. Fairbrother warns Lydgate, keep yourself independent of money complications. It's an ugly corner that you may get into. Nicholas Bulstrode embodies the novel's most complex moral exploration, a man whose religious devotion coexists with profound hypocrisy. As Middlemarch's prominent banker and evangelical Christian, he presents himself as morally superior, using religious language to justify his business practices and social influence. His downfall provides the novel's most dramatic examination of public morality, private conscience, and the relationship between past sins and present redemption. Bulstrode's carefully constructed identity rests on separating his Middlemarch present from his shadowy London past. Before arriving in Middlemarch, he worked in a pawnbroking business with questionable practices, married his employer's widow after deliberately concealing information about her runaway daughter, and diverted the daughter's inheritance to himself. These actions, while perhaps not legally criminal, violate basic moral principles of honesty and fairness. Yet Bulstrode justifies them through religious rationalization, seeing himself as a better steward of wealth than the undeserving heirs. The arrival of Raffles, who knows Bulstrode's secrets, threatens this carefully maintained separation. As Raffles repeatedly appears at Stone Court, the auction, and finally at the Shrubs, Bulstrode faces escalating pressure. His response reveals the complexity of his character: genuine terror at exposure, desperate attempts to maintain respectability, and ultimately actions that contribute to Raffles' death without crossing into outright murder. When Raffles falls ill at Stone Court, Bulstrode's failure to properly convey Lydgate's instructions to Mrs. Abel, allowing the sick man access to alcohol, represents a moral gray area between passive allowing and active causing. The town's judgment of Bulstrode comes swiftly after his past is exposed at the hospital meeting. Former associates distance themselves, his resignation from civic positions is demanded, and even his wife initially struggles with the revelation. Yet Eliot refuses simple condemnation. Mrs. Bulstrode's decision to stand by her husband in his disgrace provides one of the novel's most moving moments of loyalty and compassion. Even Bulstrode himself gains dignity through his suffering, as his carefully maintained facade crumbles to reveal genuine human vulnerability. Through Bulstrode, Eliot explores how moral judgment operates in community contexts. The townspeople's righteous condemnation often masks their own moral compromises, while the scandal provides convenient opportunity to settle old scores. The narrator cautions against hasty judgment. Even with a microscope directed on a water drop, we find ourselves making interpretations which turn out to be rather coarse. For whereas under a weak lens you may seem to see a creature exhibiting an active voracity into which other smaller creatures actively play as if they were so many animated tax pennies, a stronger lens reveals to you certain tiniest hairlets which make vortices for these victims, while the swallower waits passively at his receipt of custom. The town's judgment of Bulstrode comes swiftly after his past is exposed at the hospital meeting. Former associates distance themselves, his resignation from civic positions is demanded, and even his wife initially struggles with the revelation. Yet Eliot refuses simple condemnation. Mrs. Bulstrode's decision to stand by her husband in his disgrace provides one of the novel's most moving moments of loyalty and compassion. Even Bulstrode himself gains dignity through his suffering, as his carefully maintained facade crumbles to reveal genuine human vulnerability. Through Bulstrode, Eliot explores how moral judgment operates in community contexts. The townspeople's righteous condemnation often masks their own moral compromises, while the scandal provides convenient opportunity to settle old scores. The narrator cautions against hasty judgment. Even with a microscope directed on a water drop, we find ourselves making interpretations which turn out to be rather coarse. For whereas under a weak lens you may seem to see a creature exhibiting an active voracity into which other smaller creatures actively play as if they were so many animated tax pennies, a stronger lens reveals to you certain tiniest hairlets which make vortices for these victims while the swallower waits passively at his receipt of custom. Amid the novel's more dramatic storylines, Fred Vincey and Mary Garth provide a counterpoint of gradual moral development and earned happiness. Their relationship, spanning from childhood friendship to eventual marriage, demonstrates how character forms through daily choices and honest work, rather than grand gestures or intellectual theories. Fred begins as a charming but irresponsible young man, having failed at university and accumulated gambling debts. His expectations of inheriting Stone Court from old Featherstone have prevented him from choosing a profession, leaving him dependent on his father's generosity and dreams of future wealth. His redeeming qualities, good nature, affection for Mary, and lack of pretension, are nearly overwhelmed by his inability to take responsibility for his actions. Mary Garth represents practical wisdom and moral steadfastness. Plain in appearance but rich in character, she works as Featherstone's companion and refuses to compromise her principles even when it costs her financially. When Featherstone asks her to burn one of his wills, she refuses, despite knowing this might cost Fred his inheritance. Her love for Fred is clear-eyed rather than idealized. I have too strong a feeling for Fred to give him up for anyone else. It has taken such deep root in me, my gratitude to him for always loving me best. Their path to marriage requires Fred's transformation from idle gentleman to working man. After losing his expected inheritance, Fred must confront his limitations and find meaningful work. Mary's ultimatum, "I will never marry a man who is not respectable. I cannot bear to have a husband that is pitied," forces him to abandon his half-hearted plans for the clergy and apprentice himself to Caleb Garth in land management. Under Caleb's guidance, Fred discovers the satisfaction of useful work and gradually earns both financial independence and Mary's respect. The resolution of their story through managing Stone Court brings the novel full circle, as the property Fred once expected to inherit through luck becomes his through honest labor. Their marriage represents the novel's most straightforward happy ending, achieved not through dramatic passion or intellectual compatibility, but through mutual growth and practical wisdom. As the finale tells us, Fred never became rich, but eventually owned Stone Court outright, while Mary was always rather proud of him, even as she maintained her independent judgment. Will Ladislaw enters the novel as Casaubon's young cousin, a restless, artistic spirit who serves as counterpoint to the dried-up scholar. With his foreign appearance, poetic temperament, and undefined ambitions, Will represents everything Casaubon is not: spontaneous, passionate, and vitally engaged with life. His growing connection with Dorothea develops from intellectual sympathy to profound love, offering her the emotional fulfillment her marriage lacks. Their relationship evolves through a series of charged encounters. In Rome, Will recognizes Dorothea's unhappiness and offers intellectual companionship that contrasts with Casaubon's cold detachment. At Lowick, their conversations about art and purpose reveal their fundamental compatibility despite social differences. Even after Casaubon's death, when his vindictive codicil threatens Dorothea's inheritance if she marries Will, their connection persists through separation and misunderstanding. The obstacles to their union are formidable. Beyond the financial penalty of Casaubon's will, they face social disapproval from Dorothea's family and Middlemarch society. Sir James considers Will beneath Dorothea's station, while gossip links him to questionable parentage and political radicalism. Will himself resists pursuing Dorothea, believing that marrying her would mean living off her wealth, a prospect his pride cannot accept. When he discovers his connection to Bulstrode's tainted money, this further convinces him of the impossibility of their match. Their eventual marriage represents the novel's most radical challenge to social convention. Dorothea sacrifices wealth, position, and family approval to marry a man of uncertain prospects and questionable background. This choice, which appears to Middlemarch as a mistake made by a fine girl who had thrown herself away, embodies the novel's belief in the primacy of emotional truth over social expectation. As Dorothea tells Celia, "I could not bear the disbelief in me and the pain I should give you." The finale acknowledges that, from a conventional perspective, Dorothea's choice represents diminishment. Many who knew her thought it a pity that so substantive and rare a creature should have been absorbed into the life of another. Yet Eliot suggests that true fulfillment comes through connection rather than isolated achievement. Dorothea's ardent, beneficent, resolute nature finds expression through supporting Will's political career and raising their son, creating a different kind of meaningful life than her earlier religious idealism imagined. Middlemarch concludes with one of literature's most profound meditations on the nature of goodness and human impact. After following multiple characters through their triumphs and failures, marriages and careers, the novel asks what constitutes a meaningful life. Eliot's answer, embodied in Dorothea but applicable to all the characters, celebrates the cumulative effect of unhistoric acts that contribute to the growing good of the world. This vision of ordinary heroism permeates the novel. Dorothea's grand ambitions for social reform gradually transform into smaller but more concrete acts of kindness, supporting Lydgate during his disgrace, reconciling with Rosamond, and eventually finding purpose in love and family rather than public achievement. Lydgate, despite failing in his scientific ambitions, provides competent medical care that improves individual lives. Even Bulstrode, after his public disgrace, finds a measure of redemption through his wife's forgiveness and his arrangement for Fred to manage Stonecourt. The novel structure reinforces this theme by weaving together multiple storylines where characters affect each other in ways they cannot fully comprehend. Dorothea's loan saves Lydgate's reputation, but also indirectly enables his reconciliation with Rosamond. Fred's intervention during the railway riots helps secure his position at Stonecourt. Fairbrother's selfless advocacy for Fred with Mary represents a quiet heroism that goes largely unrecognized. These interconnections create what Eliot calls the medium in which their ardent deeds took shape, showing how individual actions ripple through the community in unpredictable ways. This perspective offers consolation for the inevitable compromises and disappointments of adult life. Few characters achieve their initial ambitions. Lydgate abandons his research, Dorothea never builds her model village, Will settles for conventional political success rather than artistic fulfillment. Yet the novel suggests that these apparent failures matter less than the quality of connection and care they bring to their immediate circles. As the narrator observes about Dorothea, her full nature spent itself in channels which had no great name on the earth, but the effect of her being on those around her was incalculably diffusive, for the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts. In this final vision, Eliot offers a profoundly democratic view of human worth. Greatness lies not in public achievement or intellectual brilliance, but in the capacity for empathy and the willingness to act on behalf of others. This moral perspective elevates the provincial lives the novel chronicles, suggesting that within the seemingly narrow confines of Middlemarch exist universal human struggles worthy of the most serious artistic attention. Through her study of provincial life, Eliot reveals the epic dimensions of ordinary existence and the heroism possible within the constraints of everyday reality.